Services is called to order, and it is the 22nd of March, 28 days until the end of our 90-day session. We have a full committee here consisting of my co-chairman, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Huggins, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator French, and Senator Wagner. And we have three items on the agenda today. The very first and most important, our good friend Paul Metz is back here to give us a presentation, if you want to come up, on the key to energy security, converting coal to gas and synthetic fuels. This is the synthetic fuel notion that Senator Wilikowski and I have been talking about excitedly, passionately, and so he's going to go ahead and do that. This is in preparation for Senate Bill 228, which this committee has heard many times. We'll bring that back up. Then Senate Bill 287, considering an in-state gas pipeline. And finally, Senate Bill 294, pertaining to sport fish guide licenses. So welcome, Mr. Metz. Thank you so much for accommodating us and coming back.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Metz, 3510 Rosie Creek Road, Fairbanks, Alaska. The comments that I'm going to be making this afternoon are mine, although I'm the director of the Mineral Industry Research Lab at the University of Alaska. This presentation is my own presentation and hasn't been approved by the university. What I'd like to do is give a brief outline of the presentation here. First, look at some of Alaska's energy challenges, looking at the alternatives for developing an energy plan, the subject of coal to synthetic gas, and then converting that gas to liquid fuels. Carbon dioxide enhanced oil recovery, and some alternatives for actually financing these mega projects, and how to get these resources to the, or the products of these resources to markets for via the Alaska Railroad, and then just a quick summary of the synergistic effects of these major energy projects. Alaska's energy challenges, of course, is all you well know, as well as I. The decreasing oil production and revenues from the North Slope, decreasing natural gas production in Cook Inlet, increasing federal and state regulations that decrease incentives to find and develop more oil, natural gas, and coal in particular, and increasing federal and state regulations that increase the cost of petroleum refining, and we expect to see more of those with the issues of climate change and carbon capture and storage. Alternate and lower costs of sources of supply of natural gas to the contiguous states that place the large diameter and the large diameter natural gas pipeline in question. And highly fluctuating energy costs as a function of the worldwide demand for petroleum, natural gas being priced as a function of the market price of petroleum. And finally, the combined negative effects of these costs and limited fuel supplies on the air cargo industry in Anchorage in particular, and the transportation and tourist industries in general. The key to developing an energy plan that provides cost-effective and stable energy supplies and energy security for Alaska and the nation includes a private-public partnership between the state, the federal government, and the various industries that facilitate the full utilization of our coal, natural gas, and petroleum resources. Our fossil fuels are and will remain major sources of energy for the foreseeable future. Just a quick look at the resources and the significance of these. Natural gas, proven reserves on the Kuparuk and Prudhoe Bay fields, about 26 TCF. Point Thompson, about another 9. A total of 35 TCF, that provides about 23 years of supply for a 4.5 BCF a day natural gas pipeline. Most gas pipelines, of course, are designed for a 30-year life or longer. So additional resources would have to be found on the North Slope to support even a 4.5 BCF a day pipeline.
Mr. Metz, could I just ask you on that point? When you look about look at the issue of gas hydrates, does the state have any data on our potential there?
We don't have any. There was a huge difference between a reserve. These are reserve estimates. That is a measured quantity under current economic conditions. A resource such as gas hydrates, coal bed methane, synthetic gas from coal, those are resources, items that are potentially useful to humans but aren't measured quantities under current economic conditions.
Got it.
So the gross value of these measured reserves at various prices of natural gas, you see ranging from 200 to nearly $500 billion dollars. By comparison, the oil in place on the North Slope when the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline came into production was about 67 billion barrels. The expected total recovery under conventional methods is estimated at 22 billion barrels. That leaves about 45 billion barrels of oil in place if the pipeline is shut down before enhanced oil recovery is put into action. The gross value of recovering 8 billion barrels of additional oil through enhanced oil recovery methods are shown here. And at the upper end, at the price levels similar to the crude oil prices we experienced in 2008, $1.1 trillion. 12 billion barrels enhanced oil recovered. You can see that at the upper end, the pushing $1.5 to $2 trillion in gross value, much larger values, of course, than the proven reserves of natural gas on the slope. By comparison, the coal resources in Alaska, which are widely distributed, are immense. The USGS estimates that the western Arctic, the Arctic slope of the Brooks Range, contains an estimated 5.5 trillion tons of high unit value coal, 15,000 BTU per pound coal. The magnitude of this resource, if we could convert our domestic resources of or our domestic requirements for electricity into 100% coal, we could generate the electrical demand for the United States for about 2,500 years. If we converted all of our liquid fuel demand, our 23 million barrel a day consumption of our importation and domestic consumption of oil to coal, as well as generated all of our electricity with coal, we would still have enough coal in the Western Arctic to supply the U.S. for about 1,000 years. These are very large resources. In addition to the Western Arctic, there's an estimated 3 trillion tons of deep coal in the Cook Inlet Basin, smaller coal resources in the upper Susitna Valley and the Indiana coal fields on the north flank of the Alaska Range. The values here at various prices per ton of coal dwarf the estimated resource values for the oil and gas, measured in thousands of trillions of dollars. In looking at it in terms of contained energy, the gas reserves on the North Slope contain about 3 × 10⁻⁶ BTUs. Oil in place, something in the neighborhood of 4 × 10⁻⁷ BTUs. And finally, the coal resources, nearly 2 × 10⁻⁰ BTUs. That's 10,000 times the energy contained in natural gas. The resources are immense. Well, what are the relationships? Are these competing energy sources or projects potentially, or is there some synergisms between the utilization of coal, the utilization of our natural gas, and the utilization of our petroleum resources? we'll look at the some of the aspects of the in-state gas line, a coal-to-liquids plant, and I'm using the Fairbanks example simply because there is a some conceptual engineering design and numbers for a project that was advocated by Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. And finally, a discussion of the enhanced oil recovery through the through the use of the CO2 that would be produced from a synthetic fuels plant. The Kipke Inlet Basin, of course, has supplied Anchorage with electrical generation and domestic and commercial heating for three plus decades. Current supplies, we expect shortages in 2015 during peak demand periods. The Department of Energy estimates that to replace the original 3 TCF of gas in Cook Inlet would cost between $5 and $6 billion, not an insignificant capital investment. The difficulty with the whole market for natural gas, of course, in the state is the low quantities that both Fairbanks and Anchorage would actually require, and bringing that resource from the North Slope is a large capital investment relative. Again, for just for the sake of having some numbers, we look at some of the preliminary numbers that NSTAR has provided in the past for the in-state or bullet gas line. Bringing natural gas from either the Gubik field, which is a dry gas play on the north flank of the Brooks Range, or alternatively from the Prudhoe Bay field, which is wet gas and would require an investment in a conditioning plant. Bringing that gas both to Fairbanks and to Anchorage and potentially to export markets. The NSTAR line is estimated add a cost estimate of initially was $3.8 billion for a 24-inch line to deliver a half a BCF of natural gas a day. The estimated cost, Anadarko's estimate for delineating sufficient resources in the Gubik field is a $1 billion estimate, and taking the large diameter gas line and scaling that $6+ billion conditioning plant to a size to handle a half a BCF a day, it isn't 1/9 the cost. It's considerably larger than that. It's about $1 billion for a conditioning plant for a half a BCF a day line. Because of the limited market and because of the high capital cost, and I think it's significantly higher than $3.8 billion, there needs to be a large domestic or international industrial user of the excess gas from that half a BCF a day line. A coal to liquids plant, as envisioned by Fedco, could actually use all of that gas. Could use actually all of the gas in the in-state line if the project was upscaled.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that a gas conditioning plant would cost $1 billion for half an MCF.
Yeah, that's what I did. Is there's a logarithmic function that's used to scale petrochemical plants. It's well documented in the literature, and I simply took the real early estimates that have been made public for the 4.5 BCF a day conditioning plant on the North Slope, and it's approximately $1 billion.
Just to follow up to that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski.
Expanding that, would it? How much would it cost to expand that to say a full B or B and a half? Do you have?
Excuse me.
Do you have any sense of how much it would cost once that was built to expand that?
There's economies. You mean to handle the 4.5 BCF a day?
Well, is it better to build a 500 MCF now and expand it later on, or is it better to just go out and do a B or B and a half?
There's insufficient market today for the 0.5 BCF a day, and to build a larger plant than that and have it idle for a considerable period of time is. Time value of investment is not a good return.
Thank you.
The Fedco project looked at a 40,000 barrel a day plant with a capital cost initially of $4.6 billion. Hatch Engineering has since revised that cost estimate down to about 3.2. The products from that plant would be Jet A and diesel, and at a production cost of about $2.60 a gallon, the plant at that scale was estimated to return about 12% on capital. Mm-hmm. Of course, in 2008, we saw prices of diesel in the interior reach $5 a gallon.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Where do they project building this?
Well, the site was at somewhere in the interior, not at this early stage. And you got to remember that this is one design at the very preliminary stage, and the ultimate plant that's built probably would look very different than this. The money that was provided initially for the Air Force was to site the plant at Eielson Air Force Base, and for a number of reasons that is not that won't happen.
Senator Wagner.
What would they propose to do with the CO2 emissions?
Well, that's what I'm proposing, is to actually use that for enhanced oil recovery on the North Slope.
So if that happens, then the plant's going to have to be closer to the North Slope.
No, the pipeline would be built to the North Slope.
Okay.
I can move on to that. The carbon dioxide emissions, for every ton of coal you burn, you get about 3.5 tons of CO2. And that might be considered a bad thing, but in the case of enhanced oil recovery, it's a very good thing. The Department of Energy in 2005 did an analysis of the potential for enhanced oil recovery on the North Slope, as well as the potential for additional enhanced oil recovery in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. There's about 8,000 kilometers of CO2 pipelines in the Mississippi Valley bringing CO2 to the offshore oil fields in the Gulf. The oil in the Gulf of Mexico, some of the fields are very amenable to immiscible CO2 injection and enhanced oil recovery, and the North Slope oil fields are as well. Mm-hmm. Cook Inlet is not, but the resource on the North Slope, of course, being very large, 45 billion barrels, we estimate, of oil.
So my apologies. Dr. Metz, on this point, so we've been talking about this idea, and I've been out to the Weyburn project in Saskatchewan, where the CO2 is piped up into the Weyburn oil fields, and they're in their ninth year, tremendous boon for them in an aging elephant of a field. What is the difference in recovery rates between CO2 and gas as a mechanism for lifting up the oil? Do you know?
When we inject natural gas or CO2, we're changing the physical characters of the chemistry of the oil and the physical character of the oil. The CO2 does several things. It reduces the viscosity, it increases the volume of the fluid, it also adds pressure to the reservoir before it becomes miscible, and therefore this all helps move the oil. Methane injection, natural gas, does the similar. It reduces the viscosity of the oil. But the CO2 enhancement is much more effective than methane injection.
I that was my instinct about it, but I've been looking for any proof of that, and there just isn't a lot of data on it.
I will pull some references for you and send those.
Second question, you said that CO2 as an enhanced oil recovery technique is not possible in Cook Inlet or not.
The oil isn't amenable to immiscible injection of CO2. The oil will not form a single, the CO2 will not form a single phase in the oil when it's injected at high pressures. And therefore, you don't get the reduction in viscosity. You don't get the increases in volume that you do on the North Slope or in the Gulf of Mexico.
Got it. Thank you.
The operators in the North Slope have experimented with this. The problem is that there is insufficient CO2. The North Slope proven gas reserves are about 10% CO2. That's the reason for part of the reason for the conditioning plant to remove the water, as well as the CO2 from the natural gas. But even if we were producing at 4.5 BCF a day, we'd still only have 1/10 of the CO2 that would be necessary for enhanced oil recovery. So there just isn't enough CO2 on the slope. That's where the coal to liquids plant comes in. The scaling the plant, that 40,000 barrel a day plant, up to what the oil industry feels is a minimum plant size for synthetic fuels of 200 barrels a day would produce about a TCF of CO2 a year. And that's what the DOE estimated would be the requirements for the recovery of 8 to 12 billion barrels of oil. The DOE estimated that in addition to the large volume of CO2, you had to have it at a reasonable price, and it was estimated at 5% of the wellhead price of oil. And certainly, at the time that they did that investigation, we were looking at $25 a barrel oil, and we're obviously way above that now. This would be the rates of return from the sale of CO2 from a 200,000 barrel a day plant at 5% of the wellhead price of oil. And this is extracted from the table that's in your handout as well. When we look at adding this to the 1/8 royalty, just a 1/8 royalty, not additional severance taxes on North Slope enhanced oil production, you can see these rates of return here. And at 1/8 of 12 billion barrels, some very, very large numbers. There is nothing that would generate this kind of income and return to the state gas.
It's amazing. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Does this include the cost of piping it up to the North Slope?
This is just from the direct sale by the plant, and we'd assume that a prudent North Slope producer would engage in the capital investment to build a pipeline sufficient. A 12-inch line at 1,300 PSI could deliver approximately a TCF of gas a year to the North Slope. CO2 is very compressible as compared to methane. And I've estimated that the pipeline at $2.5 to $3 billion capital investment. And the results here, you see, with the existing price of oil, the sale price of CO2 within 5% of the wellhead price would make that investment very attractive to the oil industry. Just a little graphic here, very schematic, showing a coal to liquids plant in someplace in Alaska. It doesn't have to be the interior. That plant, whether it received coal directly from a coal mine at 200,000 barrels a day, it would utilize about 17 million tons of coal a year, which is 10 times what the Yosemite coal mine produces today. Delivering that TCF of CO2 to the North Slope and the recovery of additional oil at simply a 1/8 royalty at $80 a barrel oil, which is approximately today's prices, the state's royalty income would be $100 billion, which is equivalent to the amount of taxes in total that we've recovered from North Slope oil production since 1977. At 12 billion barrels, of course, that increases to $120 billion. In addition, of course, the state would receive royalties on the coal that's produced, whether that be in situ gasification of the coal or in a plant. An added synergism here is that for the Susitna Dam project, adding the ability to generate hydrogen and oxygen from the electrolysis of water rather than using steam to convert the coal to methane would greatly reduce the capital cost of the CTL plant. And at 200,000 barrels a day, the CTL plant that was proposed by Hatch would use 2,000 megawatts. It would use 120 megawatts more power than Susitna. The beauty of that alternative is that once the need for CO2 on the North Slope was achieved, once oil production began to taper off, the CTL plant could be operated with hydrogen and oxygen from the electrolysis of water. The result would be a zero CO2 emission CTL plant, which would then produce liquid fuels with lower carbon emission total than refined petroleum. So there's a great synergism between the having a low-cost source of electrical energy and liquid fuels production.
Absolutely. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Are you envisioning mining the coal and then converting it, or doing underground coal gasification?
Now, underground coal gasification would, again, lower the capital and operating cost of the CTL plant, at producing coal gas and then conditioning that coal gas and transporting that to a plant at some location. That's actually much preferred alternative to mining the coal and transporting it to a plant in terms of both the capital and operating costs.
And then,
yes, Senator Wilkowski.
What is the percent of CO2 you project that you can capture from this process?
Well, the that's the $64,000 question. Is there are existing technologies that are both expensive and capital intensive, as well as have high operating costs. We would probably be looking at 70% to 80% recoveries at least, but significant cost for that recovery. The research and technology development is changing very, very quickly, and DOE is spending a lot of money in that area, as are the oil and major carbon producers. Well, just to summarize, the synergisms between a CTL plant and the enhanced oil recovery potential there for extending the life of the North Slope oil fields for another 30 years, replacement of the Cook Inlet gas with North Slope gas to Fairbanks and Anchorage, supplement the petroleum production from North Pole with low sulfur synthetic fuels. The availability of the markets outside of Alaska would not be an issue with respect to an in-state gas line. The fuel prices, the price of coal is not tied to the price of petroleum, so we'd have less fluctuation in the price of the synthetic Jet A and diesel as compared to petroleum-derived products. There would be long-term fuel supplies for the military, both in-state and in the Pacific Rim. There would be stable prices for the air cargo industry and the air transport industries in Alaska, which would again anchor those industries here. We're at great risk for losing those industries, and the air cargo industry and the air transportation industry in Anchorage alone is a significant portion of the Anchorage employment. Last Friday, the Department of Defense announced that the Defense Energy Supply Center and the Air Transportation Association of America signed a cooperative agreement for a public-private partnership to develop synthetic fuels. That's exactly what we've been saying for the last year that needs to happen. To make this work, it's going to require participation by the Defense Department, the state of Alaska, the oil and gas industry, the coal industry.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Metz. And you recall Senator Ted Stevens said that in his opening remarks to be sure to listen to what you had to say, that it was a critical part of looking at in-state gas generally. And I appreciate your comments. We've got two bills today that the presentation pertains to. The committee's been hearing Senate Bill 228 by Senator Wilkowski and I, which incentivizes precisely these kinds of plants that you're talking about through two different methods. The first is the Special Investment Tax Credit, and the other is the amendment to ACES to clarify that gas that's used in the state as a fuel or feedstock in the manufacturing process, creating an end product in the state, shall be considered as in-state gas at the in-state gas rate, the special rate. So there's that part. And then certainly in your remarks, you talk about the potential for the Alaska Railroad Corporation bonds to be used as a part of financing, or could be used as a part of financing a project like this. And so your testimony pertains to Senate Bill 287 as well, in the sense that we're asking them to look at that as well, and certainly would provide an industrial anchor. And so there's a synergy between a lot of what we're trying to do. It's a dream of mine. Senator Stevens has had to listen to Bill and I talk about it ad nauseum since we came back from South Africa, and we're just delighted to see that somebody else is out there looking at it. And I hadn't seen a presentation that put it all together that way before. And appreciate your testimony, and just look forward to continuing to talk with you more as we work through the process. Okay, so that brings us to Senate Bill 228. Then we have that before us. We had it before us last time. It's version P that has been officially adopted and sits before us. And I wanted to find out if there was any further public testimony. Anybody here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 228? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay, then hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 228. It brings the bill back before us. Again, this is the combination of tax credits for investment in a gas to liquids, coal to liquids, or biomass to liquids plant, the potential for that, and then the feedstock amendment to ACES. Any further discussion or amendments from the committee? No, I appreciate a motion. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I guess I'll say something first, then I'll make a motion. But I, the more I learn about this, the more I think it is something, a critical piece for Alaska's future. And a GTL plant, a CTL plant, or several of these plants, I think, really are critical for Alaska's future. They create anchors for the bolt line. We have the opportunity for enhanced oil recovery, significant enhanced oil recovery. We have the opportunity to create whole new industries. In conversations that we've had with experts, Madam Chair, we've learned that creating one of these plants could create 650 full-time jobs, not to mention 10 to 15,000 construction jobs. It'll help protect our bases, our military bases. It could provide heat sources for generating 350 megawatt power plants. It's a win-win-win situation. And with that, Madam Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill 228 /P out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that bill moves out of our committee into the good hands of the Finance Committee. And I know they won't hold on to it long. It's like one of those slippery pieces of legislation ready to slide onto the floor, but, you know, temporarily. And also just want to point out in your packets, we did, Sasol is one of the largest companies in this area. They weren't able to send anybody. It's not their business practice to do so, but Fish and I had a long conversation with one of their guys in Houston, and they confirmed that they've looked at Alaska now for two decades. And frankly, sadly, the reason that they haven't done more here is they consider us to be unattractive as a business climate. And that's something I think we're all continuing to work on and will continue to work on here this session and the coming sessions. But they do see Alaska as one of those prime places with the coal reserves that we have. You know, 54-foot coal seams, natural gas deposits that are stranded in nature, and then the potential for the CO2 recovery, the enhanced oil recovery. It's just a recipe for success. So with that, that is moved. We'll now bring up Senate Bill 287, and we've got a CS. Mr. Plowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Plowski, and I'm the Senator McGuire. The work draft numbers you have in front of them is the /E version dated 3/22/10.
Okay. Does everybody have that version? If not, we can get it for you. I'll look out for hand waves or cries for help. Okay,
Version E.
Yeah, version E, and it's got this memo in the front. Okay, go ahead and walk us through it, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, first of all, it's important to thank Senator Wilikowski's staff and the administration staff for working through the weekend to put this committee substitute together. The changes to the bill, some are relatively minor, some are fairly substantive. The document that you have in front of you from on Senator McGuire's letterhead, I'll walk through that document section by section and explain some of the changes and why they were undertaken. The first is changes to Section 1. Throughout Section 1, this is the purpose and findings section. Changes were made to the language, in some cases to dial back some of the findings to, I think, more reasonable levels, and some were taken out to address really with the change of the effective date how the bill and the process envisioned in the bill is moving forward. And in particular, Madam Chair, I'm referring to the language that talked about the transfer from the administration to the Alaska Railroad. In the original bill, it was a transfer of authority. With the movement to an effective date of July 1, I think that the bill now is more of an authorization rather than a transfer. It acknowledges that the work under the administration is continuing, and that will transfer to the Alaska Railroad as we authorize the railroad to conduct and move forward an in-state gas pipeline. The changes in Section 2 were added specifically to recognize that there may be other sources of gas, and this you will find on page 3, line 19 to 20 in the E version. Directing the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project to look to Gubik or Prudhoe Bay for gas was deemed to be a little bit too exclusive, Madam Chair, in case other gas was found in the region or if Point Thompson gas was available. That being that exclusive in the source language was a change. On page 4, line 1, the compatible or competitive language in sub 4 was the AGEA project was added in AS 4390 to that language. In section 4 of the bill, the primary change is on page 4D1. And you'll see the new subset, I'm sorry, that's under B1. And that's page 4, lines 4 to 5 in the E-version. And this was to establish a subsidiary corporation for the Alaska Railroad, and that was an organizational issue. Then, also in section 4, Madam Chair, you'll see page 4, line 6 in the previous version. The reading is on page 4, lines 6 through 7 in the E-version. The word acquisition was used twice, and this was just a clerical cleanup that authorization seemed to be the more appropriate word. Then the final substantive change, in the old version on page 4, lines 20 through 31, and page 5, lines 1 through 13, there was large language covering the right-of-way issue. We worked with the Department of Law over the weekend, and the new language you will find really on page 4, lines 21, through page 5, 2, line 6. And this changes the way the right-of-way is granted. Originally, the land itself was transferred to the Alaska Railroad. The concept is the actual land transfer was unnecessary and created some cumbersome management issues in the event that the project wasn't built, but that sticking with a more traditional right-of-way transfer made sense for the project. Section 5, Madam Chair, relatively minor changes up to the final changes, which you'll see on page 6, lines 16 through 17. In SB 287 envisions a process for canceling the project, and it seemed appropriate given that there are other efforts going on, be it drilling and exploration in the inlet, be it the Denali gas project, that language needed to be included that other circumstances could warrant the termination of this project. And then finally, page 6, line 18 to 19, the manner in which the legislature would express terminating the project was designed as a concurrent resolution. In the original version, the legislature had expressed, the requirement existed that the legislature had to express that the project should be terminated. The question was, of course, how would the legislature express that? Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, if I can, there was an error that drafting made that we might want to do an amendment. They've also said they're happy to fix it in the next version as we go forward, but page 6, line 20, the words immediately under were supposed to be taken out. And it reads rather clumsily that this act takes effect immediately under July 1, 2010, and Legislative Legal apologized for the error.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and just remove that. So it should just say this act takes effect.
July 1, 2010.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah, Senator Wilkowski.
Oh, Madam Chair, I would move that page 6, line 20, we remove immediately under.
Okay, any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, that motion carries. And I'll just note while we're on that subject of the effective date, Senator Stedman and his colleagues will get a chance to reflect on that date as well. We've decided to get it moving up to you, but Harry Noah and others have said that there's a field season at stake here this summer and a desire to get back in the field and continue the work that they had done, and a potential to move this date back to May 1st in order to continue on those efforts. But I'm going to go ahead and let that dialogue progress with Senator Huggins, Senator Stedman, and the guys upstairs. Okay, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just while we've got Mr. Pulaski here, I see you've got a new fiscal note, and this is not the Finance Committee, but I wonder if we could just have a couple of words about that.
Senator French, through the chair, I believe we have the Alaska Railroad online to answer questions about their fiscal note. I actually saw it right on my way to another committee earlier today.
Thank you.
Okay, and we will get to that. Let's get to that. Let's take out any further questions of Mr. Pulaski on the CS. Senator Stedman.
Just, you know, if we take a look, one of the things that it seems like we need to clean up here, and even though it might get a little messy, page page 3, lines 29 to 31, when we're dealing with these compatible but not competitive projects. I'm not so sure that ANGA isn't set up to do this very thing, that we shouldn't have a policy discussion on going in and alleviating ANGA of its duties and then heading down this other direction. Otherwise, we end up continually having a more fractured approach to the solution of getting gas. And ANGA clearly, in my mind anyway, is established to do this very thing that this bill does. So the question is, why don't we go in there, remove ANGA, restructure this, hand it over to the railroad, and start getting more focused? Because I think it's going to be difficult to get to a conclusion if every year or so we come up with another railroad track to run down. We need to be more focused on the end result, which is gas to the rail belt.
And Senator Sedman, I think it's a great point. As usual, I'm looking for your leadership on this subject too, and perhaps it's something that your committee could look on more broadly, because one of the things we did over the weekend as well is we broke out all the pieces that really need to be considered, and one of those pieces is, you know, an evaluation of the financing as well, and which entities are in place to bond and which entities may or may not wish to bond. That's part of it. Certainly ANGDA has some authority that sits out there, and we've got Senate Bill 44 that's pending in our committee as well that would give them that explicit bonding authority. I don't know what the committee's wishes are about addressing it right now. Mr. Pulaski?
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Stedman, through the chair, one of the concepts in talking with the administration and working through the issue internally is the separation between a pipeline and a shipper. And in that, the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority was working on aggregating demand through the natural gas co-op. The idea was separating out them as part of a commercial working group that might purchase gas or might be a shipper of gas, and the effort around the pipe, those being separate and distinct efforts, and if they're commingled too much, raising issues at the RCA, not that the RCA prohibits it, but that it might raise issues in terms of preferential treatment of shippers.
It is our goal, and this is a point of distinction between Speaker Chenault and I, and Charlie's a part of the team trying to move forward and how we get everybody in the mix on this subject. But it's our feeling that the railroad should be the folks looking at the building part. You're right, but that this shouldn't be competitive, but rather compatible with the efforts that ANGDA is currently undertaking and would undertake in the expansion of House Bill 44 to look at gas supply and other things. If there's language that you think makes it clearer now or when it comes to your committee, I'd be amenable. Well, if you want to just give, yeah, Senator Huggins.
The other part is, ANGDA's done a lot of work on propanes. And other items in the infrastructure for distribution, which is hugely important as we expand this, the infrastructure, not just in the rail belt and gas storage.
Yeah.
And all of those. But I guess in a larger sense, I anticipate that the House bill and this bill will go through some sort of amalgamation and metamorphosis, and some organizations will land on their feet and others will be part of a process of supporting others.
Does that suffice, Senator Stedman?
Well, not really. The issue is, I agree with the direction. I want it clear, because we've got this entity that's circulating out there trying to get gas to Alaskans, and now we're going to create another one, and then we have the AGEA process going on. And we have NSTAR, their process going on. And when we shift directions, which I'm certainly supportive of a directional shift, but I think we should start closing some of these doors behind us so we don't end up with just a continual evolution of more and more options on the table And at the end of the day, we don't get to the conclusion of getting gas. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to do. So ignoring ANGA, I think, is politically easier to do. But I don't think it helps us get to a solution any easier.
Well, and I guess for my part, I don't disagree at all. I guess for my part, I want to be clear that that was the point of the Alaska Railroad being the agency, being the exclusive place for which the work that has been done so far would be housed, and the continued assessment of an acquisition of rights of way and data would be housed. So I guess then the question is whether or not we want to eliminate any reference, page 3, lines 29 to 31, ANGDA. This was an early attempt by Mr. Plowski and I to send a friendly olive branch over to our friends in the other body to let them know that we thought that perhaps there was a role for ANGDA, but in a different place, not as the builder, not as the assessor of planning and permits and coordination of building, but rather perhaps on the supply side, and as Charlie, Senator Huggins said, on propane efforts and how they might dovetail in. I'd take more committee discussion. I mean,
well, and Madam Chair,
Senator Huggins.
Yeah. The other thing is, my assumption. One of the tasks of the railroad will be the task organization of players. I mean that's kind of why we're trying to house this there. And maybe we could describe that task organization here, or maybe it's best left to the railroad. But that's a technique. My recommendation would be leave it to the railroad.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of moving parts here that have got to be synchronized.
Well, it's on the record now, and I would invite you to continue the dialogue up in Senate Finance. And I think as we, get closer to, on this 28-day march to the end, we can start seeing. But I think Senator Stedman's right that if, ANGDA stays in place, it's got to be a clearer direction that's separate and distinct. And so we're not crossing over efforts there. And I think there's at least three bills that we could use to clarify those roles. Senator Huggins?
Well, yeah, Madam Chairman, the other thing is we have a representative from the chair of the railroad board here who might be able to shine some light on this when you look at internally how they operate and with the board and, and the railroad itself, that might be able to help us out with this just a bit.
It's wonderful. And I've asked Wendy Linskook, she's going through the channels that be able to have a few minutes on Thursday to just describe how this came to be in our working group, why we envision the railroad, and then to to take any suggestions they have as well. So it's going to be an ongoing dialogue for sure. Mr. Plowski?
If I may, Madam Chair, I believe General Gamble is also online listening right now, if there's someone who needs to.
We've got Tom Brooks and Bill O'Leary, and then, of course, we've got John Binkley here as well. So let's keep walking through here and take the additional public testimony that we didn't take, and then get to the matter of potential amendments in the bill. Okay, so with that, I'm going to go to Ralph Samuels because he waited. He was the last person in line and waited patiently last time. We didn't get to him. So, Ralph, are you there?
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
We can. Welcome to the other side of the microphone there.
We here in Fairbanks, Madam Chair, have decided that we're glad you're there and we're here.
That's great. Well, go ahead and tell us what you think of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And I just want to say that I appreciate the attention that the bill has brought to in-state gas, and I realize all the nuances of the railroad and ANGDA and all of that you guys will figure out, but just bringing the attention to the issue gets gas to Alaskans first, and I think that the in-state line provides the economic growth for jobs. It allows the private sector to see what will develop, whether you get gas to Donlin Creek or you get gas to the LNG plant in the Kiski. You certainly get gas to Fairbanks for heating homes and to South Central. So all of those things happen, I think, with more private sector investment. Once you can get a bullet line built, similar to just building a highway. You know, the last major infrastructure project I can make the argument that got built in this state was the Parks Highway that was built by government. And as far as the argument that it's not economic, I would give the argument that if you charged a toll on the Parks Highway, you'd never have built it. So this is a piece of infrastructure that I think is appropriate that the state can build. I think that everybody can tap off of it too and see what develops after that. As I'm aware from reading all of your trips to both to you and your co-chair, Madam Chair, to South Africa, as well as the trips to the Energy Council, shale gas has changed the world. It has fundamentally changed the world right now. So I think the thing that Alaskans can do more than anything else is invest in ourselves and move forward with this bullet line, because it's the one thing that we can have complete control over. You don't need export licenses, you don't need the Canadians, you don't need AGEA, you don't need Denali, you don't really need anything. Is if we just move forward and are willing to spend some money on ourselves and make this investment. And there's a little bit of a leap of faith there on making sure that the private sector is going to jump in with some of the mining and the LNG plant and all that, but I, for one, am wholeheartedly in favor of taking that leap of faith and trying to invest in ourselves. And thank you very much for showing the leadership on the issue, and really to the entire in-state gas caucus. I think that the legislature has done a very good job of showing leadership on this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ralph. We appreciate it. Any questions for Ralph? Thanks, and thanks for your patience with our committee. Okay, next we're going to go to Mr. John Binkley and then to Paul Metz. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members. I'm John Binkley. I reside on the banks of the Chena River in Fairbanks and have the privilege of being here this afternoon as chairman of the Alaska Railroad Board. As we all know, Pat Gamble, our president and CEO, has been speaking to this issue through previous hearings representing the Alaska Railroad. No surprise or news to anybody that Pat has recently been selected to preside over our University of Alaska system, and we wish him well in that endeavor and know that he will do a tremendous job. And while I do have the floor publicly, just a note of personal thanks to Pat for his 9 years of service to the Alaska Railroad Board. He's done a tremendous job, really, in moving the railroad forward. Tremendous leadership, management style, and it's been a privilege to work with him over those 9 years. And we wish him well as he goes forward. But I also want to assure the committee members and the public that the railroad is well served and certainly on track to continue forward its success that it's enjoyed over 25 years of state ownership. And that success really is not dependent on any one person, not in any particular board over the years, not even in all of its employees. All of those come together to make it successful. But the real success has been in the brilliance of this legislative body when they enacted the statutes that set the framework for the Alaska Railroad Corporation 25 years ago. And that really was taking an entity that has a very public purpose in serving the economic development aspects of Alaska, but doing it in a manner that is based on the principles of the private sector. And that is very unique. So when we, as the Alaska Railroad, look at projects, we look at the benefit to the public, our shareholders, the Alaskans, but we do it in a manner that really is dependent on serving our customers and producing a profit to our bottom line. So those are the tests that we put to any project, any expenditure that we have when we go forward with a capital budget or expenditures on a large project. And that is something unique. And it really is the DNA imprint of the Alaska Railroad Corporation that was put on by the legislature that has made it successful over the years. As has been discussed, we have very unique bonding authority, unique in the entire United States under the Internal Revenue Service Code, that allows a public entity, the Alaska Railroad, to partner with a private entity to sell tax-free bonds for a project. That all of that went away when the revisions under the tax code happened in the 1980s, with the exception of the Alaska Railroad. It was specifically written into federal law that the Alaska Railroad retained that ability. And that is very unique for a project that partners the public sector with the private sector that can sell tax-free bonds, and really gives an advantage, an edge to projects that reduce the capital costs over time because of that better bond rate being tax-free. The third aspect of the railroad really is in the structure of its board of directors. The board is made up of 7 members. 2 are commissioners from the state of Alaska, the commissioner of the Department of Transportation, and the commissioner of the Department of Commerce. And that very well complements our mission of economic development, with direct involvement with the Commissioner of Economic Development, and transportation with the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. The other members are 1 from a labor representative on the board of directors. We have 5 labor unions that represent our employees that we work with. And a very brilliant move, again by the legislature, is making certain that labor was represented on the board of directors. And that really gives them a seat at the table to make certain that they have a voice in the railroad as it goes forward, and to feel confident that they have the information that is truly, that decisions are made in the best interest of the entire railroad. And that really, although we have differences of opinion when we negotiate contracts over the years, it really has helped us to pull together. And that's an important aspect. The other 4 members are private sector individuals, 3 representing each of the judiciary districts that the railroad runs through, from Seward to North Pole and Eielson near Fairbanks. And the 4th is a private sector person at large. Those are really components that take a lot of the political side out of the decisions made by the Alaska Railroad, make them made on business decisions, and really provide the structure to have an entity that I believe is well suited for the task that you have outlined here for the Alaska Railroad. The board has not met and discussed this as a policy matter to have a firm position on this, and so my discussions this afternoon are based on individual discussions with board members and generally overall view of how we see the corporation moving forward. We will be meeting Thursday to discuss this specifically. Also, of course, to look at our procedure for bringing on a new president and CEO. But I wanted to assure committee members that as we go forward, we will have a president and a CEO, just as we did with Pat Gamble, that really brings new life, new energy, new vision to the Alaska Railroad. And I am confident that we will have an individual of that we will look back on just as we are now and saying, boy, what a brilliant move to bring that individual on, and look at how far they brought the Alaska Railroad as well. With that, I stand ready to answer any questions. We feel, although this is not a task we have sought, we certainly feel confident in the ability of the Alaska Railroad to be able to gather the talent that would be necessary to carry a project out such as this, and to move forward at as your will dictates, the will of the legislature and the administration, to move this project forward.
Thank you so much, John. We appreciate it. We, a couple months ago reached out to you in a phone call and said, what about the Alaska Railroad? And we discussed these ideas of economic development and the future of the state, and I appreciate all of your input that you've given, and know that you didn't seek it out, of course, but that you that you've been a welcome partner. I just want to say thank you, and to whatever end I can help, as I said, explain to the board, what we're thinking, and of course, continue dialogue, and it'll be up in Stedman's committee at that point. But timelines, those kinds of things, reports, those milestones. We want to work with the board and be sure that they're reasonable. They're aggressive for sure, because we want to put Alaskans in a place to be ready to launch forward and continue the work that's been done. but certainly we don't want to set up difficulties. And so we look forward to that chance to continue to talk with it. And just as an Alaskan, thank you, because you know your heart, much like all of the board members, is in our state. All the board members have years, decades of experience in the business community as well as public service. And I just feel very confident that this is something that you guys can take on and make Alaska proud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might note that standing by, if there are specific questions, Bill O'Leary, our Chief Financial Officer, and Tom Brooks, our Chief Engineer, to answer any questions on a technical nature that that committee members may have.
Excellent. We'll get to those guys for now. Any further questions for Mr. Binkley? Yes, Senator Stedman. Oh, pardon me, Senator. That's why I had my hand up.
Thanks.
I thought yours was on the fiscal note.
No, that's quite okay. Thank you, Madam Stedman. Chair. And I don't mean to interrupt, but I just we do have you here, and I would just like to ask more of a big picture question. And I know you think about these things, but just maybe you can give us your view of how you see, should this legislation pass, your organization's relationship with ANGDA going forward.
Well, and again, with a little bit of trepidation, because this has not been a board position, so I have had individual discussions with board members, but this would be my own opinion in that, and I'll preface it with that. But I think ANGDA has played an important role to this point. I think they have done a tremendous amount of work in moving this project forward. I think, as Senator Huggins mentioned, on propane alone, that's going to be very critical in sharing the benefits of this resource beyond just the gas line grid that we're talking about from Puto Bay to Homer to other areas of the state. And it's critical that that happen. And I think ANGDA has a very important role to play in that, as well as maybe other areas. So I don't see there being a difficulty in working with that entity. I think having grown up in the riverboat business, you generally need one captain of the ship when you're moving forward. But I think there's a lot of crew members that are critical to the success of a journey.
Thank you.
Well said. Senator Stedman.
I think that kind of brings up one of the points is some of us are concerned that we're not moving forward and we have too many captains on too many ships. So I agree with you 100%. One ship, one captain will most likely get us there. But maybe take a moment, because you'd brought up the bonding authority that the railroad uniquely has, and for those at home, that so they get an idea what this mechanism is, and talk about the recourse and how the, maybe your financial guy wants to do it, how the markets would perceive it, and either subscribe to them or not, and then what kind of collateral or potential negative impacts it may have on the railroad if it turned upside down, or may not have on the railroad, and how you'd insulate the railroad from that.
Well, typically, if I might, Madam Chair, these would be similar, if you're familiar, during the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, when the tank farm was built in Valdez. Very similar to what Valdez did with the TAPS owners in terms of constructing that facility in Valdez. It was actually, and these were the days prior to the change in the IRS code, where public entities could partner with private entities to sell tax-free bonds, whether they were for development of different areas or ports or different projects, just like the Valdez tank farm. And so the city of Valdez went out and bonded for the construction of that Valdez tank farm. But they're really what's called wraparound bonds. And so the recourse of the bond went back to the owners of the facility, the pipeline, or the owners of the TAPS project and the terminal facility in Valdez. So that Valdez, the city, didn't have the recourse against them, but the recourse went back to the owners of that facility. But it allowed them to sell the bonds as tax-free bonds to have a lower rate of interest on the funding to make that project work. So it's very similar to that. And that's the provision that was cut off in the 80s when they overhauled the tax code, that they specifically said, all others do not get this anymore except the Alaska Railroad. So you structure the bond so there's no recourse to the railroad, thus ultimately to the state, but to the other owners in the project.
Senator Stephanie?
Yeah, I've got to go. But thank you.
Hey, further questions? Senator Wilson?
How confident are you that the IRS will allow the issuance of these bonds?
Well, you can never be 100% in that. It's I think it's pretty clear in statute. We've done a tremendous amount of work with legal counsel, bond counsel, and others in vetting this of how real this mechanism is. And our analysis of it shows that it is a viable mechanism that is codified in federal law and in the IRS codes, and that this is something that the railroad can use. We have not utilized it to date. The bonds that were referred to earlier that we've sold aren't, they were solely bonds sold by the Alaska Railroad as an entity that can issue tax-free bonds. But we feel very confident that we'll get a positive ruling from the IRS and that we can go forward with this sale of those bonds.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yes, yeah, slightly different topic and sort of another big picture, 30,000-foot level question. The voters voted to enact ANGDA years ago. You know the history. And their purpose is to design and construct a pipeline system to bring North Slope gas to market. Who's the better organization to build this pipeline? You've got, is this within the core competency of the railroad? And I'm not saying, we've got great people there. The railroad's done a phenomenal job, but I'm just curious to hear your take. You've sat on this side of the table, and I'm just curious to hear your take on how we should be looking at this in terms of who's the best organization group to build this pipeline.
Well, and ultimately, it's a policy call that you have to make as the deciders, so to speak. But, you know, my own observation is that the railroad is well-suited for large projects. And we have and do have engineering capacity and capability, financial controls for relatively large projects as we go forward. I'm not certain of ANGDA. You know, they've had a very important role bringing projects to the point that they are. But I don't know what their competencies are in terms of actually constructing facilities or engaging in large-scale projects. So you'll have to make that value judgment. And as the policy people, you'll determine which direction we should go, and we'll carry out your will.
Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. Oh, Senator Huggins.
I'm sorry. Senator Wagner. Go ahead.
Senator Wagner?
Well, I was going to continue some on the point that Senator Wilkowski brought up. ANGDA was developed, put on the ballot, and voted on by about 63% of the people to do just exactly what we've been talking about. The problem is, every time we turn around, the legislature picks another approach to a pipeline. 2 years ago, NSTAR walked into my office and said, you know, we want to build that pipeline. The only thing we want is the help of the state of Alaska and the legislature in the permitting process so we can get a pipeline built and get us going. And all of a sudden, this thing's morphed back into the state now should build the pipeline. And so I've seen about four different approaches to building a pipeline from the North Slope, a smaller pipeline from the North Slope. I still happen to like the one that's in Aegea with the spur line coming down after we build the big pipe. But as far as somebody to actually run this project, and I understand the bonding capacity of the railroad, and that's a good thing, but maybe what we should be doing is everybody make up their mind once and for all that Aegea is the state's chosen entity because the people chose that entity. Get behind them, because every time they get a head of steam going, the legislature jerks some money out from under them, and they're sitting there with not enough money to do their job, and they give the money to somebody else. And that's what's happened twice that I know of. So I think we should support ANGDA and maybe bring the railroad in to work with ANGDA through their bonding capacity and get the people back in charge of this project that really know about gas pipelines. Because I did a little checking today, and if you hire somebody out of college to work as an engineer on a pipeline project, you're looking at about $125. If you hire somebody that's got 10, 12 years of experience and is at the executive level, you're looking at $250,000 or more just to hire that one person. And the problem we have are limited resources, and you're going to be very limited on the people you can get because those people aren't available. They're, for the most part, if they're really good, they're already working for a major corporation or a company that either designs and builds pipelines or working for an oil company that's in the gas business. And, you know, that's just a fact. And I guess the last thing I'll say is everybody talks about fast-tracking this pipeline. And I just got to say it here. One molecule of this gas is destined to go out of this state. One molecule, that's all it takes. This pipeline has to go through exactly the same process as the big line is going through. You had to do the EIS. You have to do all the permitting. You have to go to FERC and get a FERC certificate. All that has to be done. So we may be able to do this a couple of years less than the big line. But I'd sure like to see somebody, before we go off half-cocked with the railroad, I'd like to see somebody come in and give us a timeline on this project, showing the layout of the project, what they're going to do, when they're going to have their open season, when they're going to go to FERC, the whole works. Because there's no way around that. That's got to be done.
And just if I could briefly respond a couple things, and you know, the debate will continue, of course, but the railroad isn't being asked to build the gas line. I mean, there's nowhere in the bill that I've asked the railroad to build the gas line. What we're trying to do is find a place to house the good work that Harry Noah started and Mr. Swenson has continued toward this effort of an in-state gas pipeline should AGEA fail. And you're right that ANGDA was tasked in part with that, but I think some people might argue that the voters were saying we support a gas line, we want gas. I think it's always difficult to articulate exactly what they meant, whether they thought that ANGDA was going to build the line right away or whether they would gather resources or look at the issue of in-state gas more generally. But I don't think any of us believe that ANGDA has the capacity to build the railroad either. I mean, build the gas line either, and certainly that I don't think that's what you're suggesting. Where to house the team? It's a question. The debate will continue. I think the railroad's the right spot for the reasons I've articulated. The milestones that you see in the bill ask the railroad to come back to the legislature and to the governor, not to build the railroad, to come back to us and to talk about what they've amassed by way of permits and so forth, and what the efforts they have initiated are to that end. And so, you know, they'll come back with those regular milestones, and then we can decide. There's an off-ramp, as we discussed in the last hearing, for a successful open season on an AGEA-led project. But I think what most Alaskans, why you say are people trying to rush this through, I think the intensity really started, well, some would argue decades ago, but for my lifetime on this, when AGEA itself passed, I think many of us believed that giving the governor, the head of state, tools in the tool belt to get a gas line was the right thing to do. And if that was the tool belt that she wanted, then so be it. Many of us were shocked when it came back with a single bidder. And some people felt like it was a sole source contract. I mean, some people felt that way. The real concern started from a group of us that are now in the in-state gas caucus about what happens then to efforts here in our own state to develop in-state gas for Alaskans. And it started because of this 500 MCF a day limit. And the more we pushed on it, the more we realized that really was a sweet spot that people didn't want to give up. And that was when the amendment was put in to say then, all right, we're going to put $10 million into in-state efforts as well, because that's important. And Harry Noah, we know the rest, was appointed. His team did great work. The commercial working group, I've got people that come through my office all the time and say, we can't wait to continue working. The engineers, the field work that they've amassed has been good, and it will be valuable to the state. So that's really the point of the railroad. The bonding authority is what I think sets the railroad apart, and the fact that they're really the only people building things in the state, in the public sector, quasi-public sector anymore. The DOT is the commissioner is on the board. I think that's great. DCD commissioner on the board. I think that's fantastic. And again, the fact that it is a public corporation and yet it's charged with making a profit and bringing buyers and sellers together, I think that's the kind of the deciding point that we had. So that's the reason for it. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I guess, you know, I remind us back to our working lunch today, and the governor has signed on to your concept with the railroad. That's huge. I mean, we want to work in coordination with the governor, and I know that he's very proud and very supportive of the railroad. But, you know, and that's good. And quite frankly, that's great movement for getting something done. The other part, though, is that, and the thing that I find attractive about the railroad is good people, but they will have sweat equity, but they're going to be the benefactors. I mean, if you think about a concrete plant up at Livengood, as an example, we get gas to them. We get gas to Flint Hills. There will be more fuel to be hauled at hopefully a more reasonable price. And just think of all the construction material. We start building this line and in preparation for the corridors that the railroad will be hauling, keeping off of our highways. So, you know, if I was in the railroad business, I'd say there's a lot in here for me. And we get sweat equity. And, oh, by the way, you know, they're motivated by, you know, doing well by the railroad and the future of the railroad. Because I remember Pat Gamble in about the last 3 weeks portraying the railroad over the next 2 years as hunkering down. Because their commodity haul was down, their passenger haul was down. And it is a robust organization, very capable people, run by a good board, and I'm very supportive of your concept.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Anything further, Senator Wagner?
Just one correction.
Yeah, absolutely.
There wasn't a sole source. There was more than one applicant on the AGEA process.
Yeah, no, I didn't say that it was a fact. I said that there were some people that felt that way.
I just wanted to clarify that there were more than one, and as a matter of fact, most of us were disappointed that one other one that was would have been very competitive did not show up and make an application.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's the process we went through.
Yep.
And so that's where we're at.
That's right. That's right. I just wanted to kind of lay that out so that the public's reminded and folks in the building that, you know, that this really isn't. It isn't chaotic. We're not just throwing things out. That there really was an effort underway well back during the debate and the vote on AGEA. It began then, and we're carrying it out today, and it's an extension of it today, this bill. So any final remarks?
Yes.
Oh, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, no, I'll just say we have to come to a conclusion, I think, this session. I'm just hearing that another organization that was looking at building a pipeline in state has said they're no longer interested because of uncertainty about whether the state's going to be involved, whether the state's not going to be involved. And I just think we need to come to a decision as a legislature. This year, we've gone, as Senator Wagner mentioned, we've gone through a number of different changes and iterations on who's going to build this. We have to come to a consensus on this, come to an agreement, and just go ahead and do it.
Thank you.
I'd just like to applaud you, Madam Chair, the co-chair of the committee, for your efforts on this, the Gas Caucus. I think this really is a parallel track to AGEA. I think it's important to see both of those to their conclusion, and certainly would concur with Senator Wilkowski of having something definitive that comes out of this legislative session. I think the people of Alaska are certainly waiting and ready for that.
Thank you very much. And we'll have Paul Metz testify, and then...
And I'll be here if there's
okay,
any other...
Okay, great. Paul Metz, and then we're going to go ahead and just pull the bill up, because I know that some of the folks here online, I think, have to do with potential amendments or amendments that might be offered in Senate Finance. We'll find out. It's Paul Metz, Dr. Metz.
Madam Chair, that the previous presentation that I made incorporated my comments with respect to the in-state gas line. That table that I gave you as an addition to the white paper. If you had any questions on that, I'd address those, but I don't have any further comments.
Thank you very much. Okay, so that brings the bill back before us. This is version E. We made amendment number one, which was a technical amendment removing immediately under in the effective date. It brings the bill back before us for movement of the bill out. Senator Wilikowski.
Are you looking for a motion, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, no, I had an amendment I'd like to.
Senator French.
I'm sorry, I don't serve on the Finance Committee. I don't have an opportunity to.
I have an amendment also.
Yep, great. Okay. I don't have a chance to bring amendments there.
Okay.
So this is my chance.
Senator
to do
French.
That. Yep, thank you so much. I have a /E.1 that I guess I'll style amendment number two. That is an amendment dealing with project labor agreements. I think most of the committee members are familiar with what they do and what they bring to a project of this size. I do have some folks lined up to testify, and so in the interest of time, I will not make a lengthy statement on the amendment. I'll turn it over to those knowledgeable individuals who'd like to speak to amendment number two.
Okay, we'll object and hear testimony. Mr. Plasky, do you have anything on this amendment? No. Okay. I'll go ahead and walk through the lineup. What Senator French was referring to about the Finance Committee, so the issue of project labor agreements, I think, is very important. We've got conflicting meetings today with people who have strong views about this, and so I was looking to see if this debate could continue upstairs. But fair point, he's on the committee, and I think, you know, all big projects have certainly incorporated project labor agreements in them, and it's a fair point to bring it up. So let's hear the testimony. Just mindful of the clock, it's 5:05. So if you're here to speak in favor or against the amendment, if you could try to keep it to 3 minutes, I'd really appreciate it. So I'll go ahead and start with Tim Sharp in Fairbanks. Tim, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All the committee members for taking the time to listen. My name is Tim Sharp. I'm the business manager of the Alaska District Council of Laborers. We're made up of 5,000 Alaskan workers and their families. We're excited as we sit here listening about the project and the jobs. We're here today to speak to in favor of Amendment 2 that would require a project labor agreement and make sure Alaskans get those jobs on the proposed bullet line. You mentioned already, and I think I don't want to recover it, but most projects of this size in Alaska have had project labor agreements from TAPS, ANGA, Port Authority, AGIA. We've been here before. It's not new ground. Many, if not most, of our state leadership also recognize the needs for project labor agreements on projects of this size. Governor Knowles supported project labor agreements. As both Governor and Senator Frank Murkowski supported project labor agreements. Senator Ted Stevens supported them on ANWR and the gas line. Governor Palin also, in her AGIA, supported project labor. Sitting commissioners of laborers and their predecessors, Native corporations, even Governor Parnell kept it in AGIA after some pretty intense lobbying. But when the question was called for, they led. They continue to lead without being concerned about making friends on the conservative talk show circuit, especially, who are also and always anti anything to do with a project labor agreement. We take it for granted. It was the right thing to do for Alaska then, it's true today. First and foremost, the reason is that we can contractually make certain that Alaskans are trained and hired for the jobs. They are on the jobs first and laid off last. We don't need the fluff numbers and false promises from other large contractors and multinational corporations with words like may, will endeavor to, when it comes to Alaska hire. You've probably seen the commissioner's Department of Labor Commissioner Click Bishop's report on Alaska hire, and the way things are today without project labor agreements, things are continually getting worse in the oil fields and not better. It also means that real apprenticeship programs with track records of creating jobs and careers for Alaskans will put strongly into play. It contractually ensures Alaskan Native participation will also be involved in the project. We strongly support, especially as Fairbanksans, energy and gas development in the state, but at the end of the day, while the project is being built, a PLA means the money will stay in Alaska because Alaskan participation is enforceable, unlike the travesty that is occurring on a daily basis in Prudhoe Bay. A PLA means Alaskans first, and we would support the amendment, and I'd answer any questions.
Okay, there's Senator French.
Just wanted to say thank you to Mr. Sharp.
Okay. Mike Littlefield.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it. In the interest of time, I'd like to leave mine short and sweet. We would also, as the Teamsters Local 959, we would
Mayor, what Mr. Sharp said. We're in support of a project labor agreement. We want to see Alaskans working on an Alaskan project. And in the interest of time, that's about all I have to say. I would be happy to accept any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, Ron McFeeters in Palmer, please. Ron, are you there? Are you there? Okay, then we'll go to Vince Beltrami.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
We can.
Thank you. My name is Vince Beltrami. I'm president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, representing 60,000 Alaskans and their families. And thanks for the opportunity to testify on this critical issue. It's great to hear more discussion about trying to get gas to market, get it to the interior and south central. And I also am testifying in favor of amending SB 287 to include a project labor agreement negotiated with the proper labor organizations. Now, Mr. Sharp up there touched on a lot of the major reasons, so I won't go over a lot of that, but there's tons of arguments in support of using PLAs. There's tons of documentation that show they're good, sound business decisions and in determining predictability and planning, construction, scheduling, labor needs, safety programs, et cetera. AGEA, as was mentioned, has a PLA requirement. ANGDA has a PLA requirement in it. If you look at what we've done around the state of Alaska, the Building Trades Councils have negotiated and worked under dozens of PLAs over the years. One of the big ones that comes to mind most recently was the Ground-Based Missile Defense Project in Shimia and Delta Junction. The management of those prime contractors, which were Fluor and Bechtel, raved about how well that PLA worked on a real large project, put over 1,000 people to work, over 90% Alaska hire, 12% Alaska Native hire, and 17% minority hire, all while training hundreds of apprentices who are now working as journeymen in their chosen fields. And without a hitch, that job has been done on time and under budget. Like I said, we've laid out a lot of the reasons kind of ad nauseum over the years and the advantages for not only for the employees, but for employers and for project owners. And one thing we do know that we can quantify is in the type of workers that would do this, heavy and highway type construction, 85% of those workers in the state of Alaska are already represented by unions, and 85% of the federally registered apprentices are actually in our union apprenticeship programs. So while there's tons of arguments in favor of, there's only usually a couple of what I would, not to badmouth our detractors, but would say are kind of a couple of really poorly articulated objections or arguments against PLAs. And a lot of the objections kind of go back 30 years to, you know, a time when it was, there were a lot of complaints made about people coming up from outside of the state. Well, I can tell you that this generation of labor leaders has made a significant effort to make sure that Alaskans will go to work first on these projects, whether they currently belong to a union or not. We've all knocked down a lot of the barriers to membership, and it's really easy to get non-union people that are interested in going to work on a project like this signed up, you know, tested and ready to go, so they're ready to have all the rights that a resident union member would have before anybody would be able to go out on a job from the lower 48. So that's one of the common myths that's out there that's used quite a bit to try to badmouth what is seen across the country these days as good public policy. In fact, there's a new studies have come out. There's, you know, I would encourage any committee members that want to see what the record is to look at there's a website called PLAsWork.org, and it's got recent studies out of the Michigan State University, out of the University of Tennessee, where experts in the field have kind of debunked a lot of the myths surrounding PLAs, and I encourage you to look at those. Without going any further, I'm not sure where, you know, we're at in the process, so I'll try to summarize now, but I respectfully ask that you consider amending SB 287 to include the provisions of a PLA between the successful applicants here or whatever the organization, the railroad, et cetera, and the Building Trades Council for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans. I thank you for the time and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And we do have a question, Senator Wagner.
Yeah, quick question. What can we do? I've got the amendment in front of me, but one of my worries is out-of-state call-ups versus in-state hires. And what can we do to ensure the workers in the state of Alaska that they would be called up? You know, you go down through your A list, B list, C list, however many lists you have. And what can we do to assure us that if we have a project labor agreement, that in fact the Alaskans will have first call when you start hiring other folks, when you run out of people on your books?
Well, and I would, to answer that through the chair, Senator Wagner, that is one of the things we have really worked on over the years, is trying to, we all have certain referral procedures within the various unions of how people go to work and in what order. And it used to be that kind of that memory you probably have of out-of-state workers coming up here, they would have the opportunity to go to work first, potentially, if they, you know, met all the other requirements. But now, if you basically, I'm not sure how to let you know other than to tell you, and you could do a poll of any of these business managers of these building trades unions, and they'd be able to show you in the referral procedures how they have, you know, altered those over the years to make sure that Alaskan residents who are qualified go to work before we would be putting to work, you know, resident or people from outside of the state. And that's one thing that is substantiated. And in these studies that I referred to, it shows that that a PLA is the only way to legally enforce any kind of a local hire. And another thing that Mr. Sharp mentioned was that with the trend we've seen in the commissioner's report on resident hire, definitely left you know, something to be desired. It shows that this year there's more people actually working in the oil fields than there were, you know, a year ago at this time, but there's less Alaskans working in the oil field than there was a year ago at this time. So the only obviously logical conclusion is that there's too many people still being imported and taking jobs away from Alaskans now. And I think a PLA is the only legal means that you could look at, and I'd be happy to, you know, walk folks through, you know, after this or at some other time, give them the information to show them how our referral procedures work in that way.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Wagner.
You didn't answer my question, though.
I didn't?
No. The question I ask is, how can we assure verbally in this amendment or an additional amendment that does take place?
Well, by nature of a project labor agreement, it typically refers to the referral language that is in place at those local unions. And if you want, I mean, I don't know what the amendment says. I haven't seen it yet. But I would, I mean, certainly be open to amending it to your concern, which would essentially reiterate that the union referral procedures must make sure that, you know, local hire provisions are you know, taken into consideration, because I know that in those processes, which when you sign up for a PLA, that's what you're signing up for, is those referral procedures, that it has, you know, mandatory language that makes sure that qualified residents go to work before non-residents.
Well, we're not getting there very fast, though. Okay, that's all I needed.
Okay, well, it's a good place the dialogue can continue on that subject. I mean, I think that's of course the concern people like me have. I want Alaskans going to work, both private sector and union labor. I want Alaskans working, and I know that there has been a difficulty in adopting an in-state hire provision, but we'll keep tweaking it and looking at it. We've been looking at it with respect to an ACES credit and some other things that, you know, when you look at incentives, there may be a way. But I support the line of questioning Senator Wagner had. And I think, you know, in general, that process needs to get out into the marketplace of ideas more, so that people can understand. That's one of the common pushbacks on PLAs is, you know, well, is it going to put unionized members from out of state to work ahead of the 83% plus of Alaskans who are not affiliated and who are working here in Alaska and who want a good paying job too? So, okay, I've got, it looks like, just two more folks here. Merrick Pierce.
Oh, it's not good.
Good afternoon. They're
good afternoon.
Finance. I'm Eric Pierce, and I serve on the board of the voter-created Alaska Gaslight Port Authority, and I'm speaking on my own behalf. And say good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and committee members.
Good afternoon.
Very good. To Senate Bill 287, the one aspect of this bill that I find slightly encouraging in the now the 66th year of pipeline discussions, I note the first gas line study was completed in 1954, is the rendition of the basic facts summarized in the legislative findings and purpose in Section 1. Alaska does urgently need a diversified revenue stream, and Alaskans do need affordable energy. The problem with this bill is the extraordinary disconnect that I see between the findings and the stated purpose. If we are going to make the case that we have a problem, an urgent need for both new revenue and affordable natural gas for Alaskans, why turn the gas pipeline over to a railroad that soon will not even have a CEO? Why wouldn't the primary responsibility be invested in ANGDA, an organization with public support and both the institutional knowledge and expertise and the strong desire to see the Alaska Gas Line and the spur line to South Central be built? Additionally, ANGDA has also partnered with AGPA, who also has a voter mandate, and partners who are very interested in Alaska LNG, both for the west coast of the United States as well as the world markets. The second problem relates with this bill to the first. If we urgently desire a gas line and expect to move forward with a real project after the failed open season and the scuttling of AGEA, why would we waste time and effort studying a gas line down the parks that doesn't provide the lowest cost gas for Alaskans, doesn't have an EIS, doesn't have a right-of-way, and doesn't even deliver gas to the military bases, mines, and small communities that need gas? The All-Alaska Gas Line is designed by YPC, has a final environmental impact statement, has an established right-of-way, has economy of scale, delivers gas to our military bases and a host of communities along its route that do not now have affordable energy.
Okay.
If you want to see what the voter-mandated route in the city served and the cost savings to the interior looks like, you can go to a website that I've put together. It's mygasline.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Merrick. We appreciate it. Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and come back to the amendment here. We've got amendment number 2 by Senator French. Further committee discussion on the amendment. Yes, Senator French.
Maybe just by way of wrap-up, Madam Chair, I know we've gone a long time, but you know, I think what we heard was that on the last major project completed in this state under a project labor agreement, we had 90% Alaska hire, which I guess I would defy anyone to bring me a major project that was done with more Alaskan workers than that. So I understand there's some residual concerns about how this worked in the past, but what we're hearing, fresh evidence, is that you get 90% Alaska hire, and that's the major impetus behind this amendment. Thank you.
Great, and I'm just going to speak to explain my vote at this time. I support project labor agreements generally. I think they work. There is a split, and this has come later on in the process of the bill. I want the bill to move forward. There are some folks who are uncomfortable with aspects of the language. We don't have the full committee here, but in general, I'd like us to keep looking at this issue and the broader question, both of PLAs and in-state hire, and how we can get at some kind of provision in the bill that addresses that more broadly. I've got a split in my constituents, of course, and I want my constituents in both the private sector and in the in organized labor to have good jobs, and that's the point of the bill. So that's my vote for now, and I'd like the bill, you know, to keep moving on in the process. So with that, Madam Secretary, are you calling the roll, Shalon? Who's calling? Madam Secretary, you're calling the roll. Please.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stedman? Senator Stevens? Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Wagner?
I'm just trying to, what was your vote?
I haven't voted yet.
Oh, well, you qualified everything the way you're going to vote. I'll vote no.
Senator Wilikowski?
Yes.
Senator McGuire?
No.
Two yeas and three nays.
Two yays, three nays. Okay, so the amendment fails to carry at this time, but Senator French is going to forward this language to Senator Thomas and some others, and work will continue with Senator Wagner at the helm as well, I think. And so with that, the bill is before us as amended one time for us, another amendment by Senator Wagner.
I have an amendment to offer, Madam Chairman.
And I'm told John Binkley can help us on this.
I have no idea what the amendment
is. John doesn't know what this is about.
Okay.
Lend any assistance.
He'll probably scream when he finds out what it is.
Okay, amendment number three. You want to go ahead and move it?
I'd move amendment number three.
Okay, I'll object.
So what this amendment does, it for this project only, it puts the railroad under the Executive Budget Act, just like ANGDA or any other corporations, ADA or anybody else. And I think it's important that if the railroad is going to be the focal point on building a pipeline and coordinating all these different agencies, if they build the pipeline and operate the pipeline, they should be under the Executive Budget Act on this pipeline. I see no reason they shouldn't be.
Okay, committee discussion. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed out what you're trying to do here, Senator Wagner. Could you just explain that again?
Right now, the railroad does not fall under the Executive Budget Act of the state of Alaska, of the legislature. And it's what this would do is, as far as just this bill, and if they become the agency for the in-state gas pipeline, then they would fall under the Executive Budget Act.
Senator French.
I guess I have a follow-up question. Maybe you could just sort of articulate a little bit about, you know, what that means in practical terms. Does it mean, I mean, who, you know.
That means they will be responsible to the legislature for the budgeting. And if there's a profit, you know, I mean, I don't see why we should let them stay outside of the Executive Budget Act on a project of this nature.
Okay, Mr. Binkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to lend my 2 cents worth.
I knew you would.
You know, when I discussed earlier really the brilliance of the statutory framework that established the Alaska Railroad, this goes right to the heart of it. And this is really what distinguishes the Alaska Railroad from any other state agency. And in my humble opinion, is what has been at the heart of the success of the Alaska Railroad for the last 25 years. Because any entity looks to where its funding source is for its direction. The Alaska Railroad looks to its customers and to profitability as its funding source, not to a political body. And that is the heart of the difference between the Alaska Railroad and the Department of Transportation or any other entity. And that's why, in my opinion, it's been successful. And what distinguishes it from any other entity. And so I would just say that I think that, with all due respect to Senator Wagner, this really would take away from the debate one of the most compelling reasons why it should be housed within the Alaska Railroad. This provision that exempts us from the Executive Budget Act means that we respond to our customers instead of to a political body. And that's why we have been less political than other entities over time and have been successful in not relying on any state subsidy for the moving forward of the Alaska Railroad. And this really cuts that DNA of the Alaska Railroad out from under us. So I would certainly think that it would be damaging for the railroad's ability to act quickly. Right now we have the capability to make decisions quickly based on what business cases are. I'll give you a brief example. We were looking at a contract with one of the producers on the North Slope about taking drilling pipe out of gondolas, a particular type of car, rail car that we have, loading them directly onto flat high decks to take immediately up to the North Slope. We had to invest $500,000 in the equipment to be able to do that, to expedite it. We looked at the business case. There was a way to make money off of that. It penciled out. We bought the equipment. We did the project and have made money off of that. What this would say is that you no longer have the ability to do that. You have to, like any other agency, go through the process of starting to build your budget in August through the different departments that you're responsible to, bring them up through OMB, wait to have an appropriation introduced through the governor's bill, be heard through the legislative process in the session, wait until the bill is signed into law, and then know if you've got the money or not to do something like that.
Got it.
It really slows down the process, and the way that the railroad is able to respond to changes in the market, to business decisions that really have made us successful over the years.
Okay, further discussion?
I'll just read to you the language in ANGDA's. It says, the revenue earned by operations of the authority must be identified as the source of the operating budget of the authority and the state's operating budget under AS 3707. I don't think it's as complicated as some people would think, but the thing it does, it at least gives some legislative control. I mean, the way I see this bill going, we're taking the governor out of the picture, the legislature out of the picture. I just don't think, I for one, as a legislator, don't want to go there. And if I don't have some part of the legislature having some control over this project, then I'm sorry, I'm a no vote.
Okay. Well, one of the things about the bill, it does ask them to make regular findings and, you know, milestone achievement reports to us. Requires them to provide monthly reports to presiding officers of each house of the legislature and to the governor on the corporation's activities relating to the project. So I just don't want us to think there's no oversight. Any further discussion? Senator Wilkowski?
I certainly respect and appreciate the amendment. I think I'm probably going to oppose it, though, because I think part of the problem has been too much legislative intervention. I think we, again, need to make a decision, hand it over to a competent group of professionals, and with oversight, which we will have, let them go ahead and do this. I don't know that I'm going to support this bill as a whole. I still haven't made up my mind. I think there's very good parts of it. I don't know if it should be ANGDA, if it should be the railroad, but I think that whoever we decide to give this to, we need to let them go out and be professionals and stop the legislature from micromanaging this project.
Senator Wagner.
I agree it's been micromanaged to death already. But my point is, a report is not oversight. A report is just that. It's whatever's written and turned into the legislature. It has there's no controls in a report. And the other thing I'd say, the gentleman that testified earlier, and I know Mr. Binkley and the board are going to start searching for a CEO. But right now we're talking about turning over a pipeline project to a railroad that doesn't have a CEO in charge of it right now. So I don't know what the time frame is, but you don't just go out and hire a CEO for a railroad. You just, I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. And I think
understand.
Mr. Binkley would admit that.
So, Senator Wagner, at this time, I'm going to oppose it for the reasons that Mr. Binkley articulated, but it'll stay out there in the marketplace of ideas if it doesn't pass today. If it does, then it's there. When it goes up to the Senate Finance Committee, I imagine we'll be hearing more news from the railroad. And again, I'm not concerned about the change in CEO. We've had wonderful CEOs of the railroad. They've all been great, and I don't expect any less in the next. And the organization, its bonding authority, and all those things remain. But I appreciate the sentiment. So it's been objected to, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. you know, I guess I will remain open-minded. I'm going to oppose the amendment, but you know, you can't ask organizations like the railroad to have a foot in one day and a foot out the next day. It has to be consistent, and organizations get confused when you do that. And, you know, to be quite frank, in my experience, there are two organizations, the railroad being one of them, that when they come and they present, they're organized, they're convincing, and the numbers add up, and you go away saying, golly, that is one efficient organization. And so I guess I have great confidence in the railroad and what they're doing in the structure. And I just remember back when we did the $165 million worth of bonding for them, I had zero hesitation about, and I look at the product they've done by virtue of that. So in any event, I will remain open-minded to the proposal, but at this point in time, I will oppose the amendment.
Senator Wagner.
This is kind of an aside, but and I don't know. I've heard this rumor. But, John, is it true? Was the railroad or a portion of the railroad discussing purchasing the North Pole Refinery, Foothills? Had the railroad entered into any negotiations to purchase Foothills Refinery?
No, through the chair, no. We never entered into any negotiations about purchasing the Flint Hills Refinery, Senator.
Had there been discussions at the board level about that?
Well, I think during the previous administration, I think there was a statement through the governor, as I recall, about having the railroad involved in some solution to making certain that the refinery remained in place and producing fuel for both the interior and South Central. But there were never any negotiations between the railroad and Flint Hills in that regard.
Yeah,
thank you.
Just
Senator Huggins. Yeah,
Madam Chair, I was involved, not with the board of the railroad, but I was involved with during some of that era of conversations, and there were some people in the administration were sort of advocating in that direction, and I only saw General Gamble in that process, and he was very resistant to it. I mean, he said, you know, this is a last resort sort of thing. So that, but that wasn't the board or any of that sort of thing.
Okay, so is there a motion, Senator Huggins?
On the amendment?
Well, on the amendment. We've got to do the amendment.
Call the roll.
There's a, yes. There is a an objection to amendment number 3, and we've had debate and discussion, so we'll call the roll. Madam Secretary, please.
Senator Stevens? Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Stedman? Senator Wagner?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Senator Wilkowski?
No.
And so the amendment fails to carry at this time, but good points, Senator Wagner, on the amendment. Okay, that brings the bill back before us. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the CS for Senate Bill 287 be moved from committee with as amended with individual comments.
Object.
There's an objection to the bill moving on to finance. Madam Secretary, can you call the roll?
Senator Stedman, Senator Stevens, Senator Huggins?
Yes.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yes.
Senator McGuire?
Yes.
4 days, 1 day.
And so the bill moves on, and I appreciate everyone's patience, and I noted Representative Newman and Representative Bramris and Representative Wilson were here today, so thanks to our House colleagues for joining us, and thanks for all the hard work, and thank you, Dr. Metz, for remaining, and thank you, Mr. Binkley, for coming in personally, and we wish you luck on Thursday. And with that, we're adjourned.